Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is the displacement of nonprofits from San Francisco. Is the current economic boom imperiling San Francisco's nonprofit organizations? According to the Board of Supervisors budget and legislative analyst, the city's recent robust job growth has come with a downside. Between 2011 and 2013, commercial rental rates have increased by more than 32%, and the city's commercial vacancy rate has fallen to about 9%. And in the hotly sought-after mid- and south-of-market neighborhoods, those figures edge even higher. So it's not surprising that for nonprofits seeking to renew leases or, in some cases, avoid early lease termination, today's economic climate poses significant challenges. This hour, we'll explore the scope of the problem. Are things really as bad as during the last dot-com boom? Or are they worse? And we'll discuss potential solutions to stabilize and support the city's nonprofit service and arts organizations, and to help ensure that they can remain in the communities they serve. Joining me tonight to discuss these issues and more are Supervisor Jane Kim. She's representing San Francisco's District 6, which includes the Tenderloin, Mid-Market, South of Market neighborhoods. Supervisor Kim has called for a work group to find solutions to the challenges escalating rents pose to San Francisco's nonprofits. Welcome, Supervisor Kim. Okay, I don't have her. We're going to go on. We are also joined by Brian Chu. He is Director of Community Development with the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. And Brian is chairing the work group on nonprofit displacement that was convened by Supervisor Kim. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And also in the studio with me tonight is Debbie Lerman. She's administrator of the San Francisco Human Services Network, an association of over 100 community-based nonprofit agencies dedicated to addressing issues critical to the city's health and human services sector. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you.
And finally, we have Michael Pappas, executive director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council, a nonprofit organization dedicated to serving the community, bringing people together to build understanding and celebrating our diverse faiths and spiritual traditions. Welcome back to the program, Michael.
It's great to be back.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation this evening. We've already gotten a few comments on our website and email. You can call in at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions917@gmail.com, or you can post a comment at kalw.org. So I hear that Supervisor Kim is now with us. Are you here?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have been online. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. No worries. Great. So I wanted to start with you. Welcome to the program, by the way. I would ask how you became aware of this problem and what did it mean to you when you found out about it?
Sure. So back in August, a group of nonprofits, many who are represented by the Human Services Network, approached me regarding a crisis that they were seeing as many of their leases were coming to an end, which is an unbelievable increase in commercial rents, up to 150% in the spaces that they were currently renting. Many of these nonprofits are concentrated in the mid-market area and the south of market area. But we also know that there are many other nonprofits in the Tenderloin and Mission. And we know that these organizations provide vital resources, whether it's providing services to our most vulnerable needy, after-school programs, senior lunch programs, and also our visual and performing arts.
And so what did they say to you was their need at that time? Were they already in the midst of dealing with these increased rents? Did they see it coming? I'm just curious how urgent the call was at that time in August.
Yeah, so we have a whole range of organizations. Some were predicting it as their leases were coming to an end over the next year and a year and a half, and had already begun talking to their landlords and getting a sense that their leases were going to go up, again, up to 150% of what they are today. We also have nonprofits that are today looking for spaces but are unable to find a space that they can afford. And as you had mentioned earlier, you know, while we're incredibly excited that our economy is strong and that many companies, in particular our tech companies, are interested in being in San Francisco, vacancy rates in the Eastern SoMa and Western SoMa are down to 6.7% all the way to 2.8%. And unfortunately, these competitive neighborhoods are often where our nonprofit communities reside.
So you called for reports from the or an analysis by the Board of Supervisors budget and legislative analyst. You quoted a couple of things that you found out from that report. What else was in that report that surprised you?
You know, so we have 6,005 nonprofit organizations in San Francisco. And so I didn't realize kind of the depths of which we have nonprofit organizations. But I think what was most stunning was our commercial vacancy rate, which I said is as low as 2.8% in Western Soma. We know that nonprofits are stable long-term tenants, and even real estate advisors are suggesting that property owners diversify their portfolio and not just bet on tech companies. As we know, 80% of all new businesses do fail, and we got to make sure that we are keeping everyone here in San Francisco. But I think the vacancy rate was what had stunned me the most.
And I think something else I had read there was it almost a quarter of those nonprofits are contractors with the city of San Francisco, meaning that the city provides them with funds to execute their mission of providing health and human services. Is that right?
Yes. So we do fund many of our nonprofit services, which actually provide services at a much more affordable rate than the city could provide them on our own, whether it's public health needs, soup kitchens, or even employment training programs that we have. And so actually, even on a selfish level, even if we weren't to consider nonprofits, on a city level, we have to be concerned, because if our nonprofits can't afford the rents that they're paying today, they're going to be asking our general taxpayer dollars to give more so that they can continue to provide the level of services while staying in San Francisco.
So you voted for the Twitter tax break that a lot of people have had concerns about. And I'm curious how you see that decision of yours today in light of this rise in commercial rents. Do you regret your decision? Do you see it was kind of necessary at the time? And do you see this as kind of the normal ebb and flow of how economic cycles turn? And now we're just, you know, we're coming around to this problem that was created by a different solution at some other point.
Yeah, so I'll say a couple of things. You know, in 2011, we were hitting rock bottom in our economy. I had spent several years on the school board with cutting our school budgets, and the city had been going through the same thing. Our unemployment rate was at an all-time high. So at the time, the policy decision to help encourage tech companies and other companies come to a corridor with actually the highest commercial vacancy rate in the city, that was mid-market. Mid-market had the highest commercial vacancy rate in the city. It was policy that made sense at the time. We did, of course, make sure that we kept it at 6 years to limit the tax exclusion. But now we're finding that, you know, our policy was wildly successful, not just in mid-market, but even in parts of San Francisco where there's no tax exclusion. And so now I feel we are accountable as policymakers to ensure that everyone can stay in San Francisco, that there are that we are also addressing negative side outcomes of policies that we enacted, which also had tons of positives for the city.
And was there a way at the time for you to predict that several years down the road we'd be here having this discussion?
You know, in 2011, there's no way I would have predicted that what was going to happened today. In many ways, we see that our economy is very cyclical. It is in very many ways similar to what we saw in 2000. In fact, when I read the city and Compass Point report in 2000 on what we can do to support nonprofits that were then getting squeezed out of the rental market, it's like you could be reading that report today. And so what I think is really important is now we really actually need to perform and enact some of these long-term strategies so that we're not going through this every cycle.
Right. So you did convene a task force, and Brian Chu is here to talk about that. What are you hoping will come out of this? What would be a good outcome, both in the short term and the long term, from this task force work?
So, as you said, I think we need both short-term solutions and long-term solutions. So we're looking for proposals that we can enact today that would do both. Short-term solutions, of course, can include providing our nonprofits with more funding from a general taxpayer base. This doesn't really solve a problem. It's just transferring our tax dollars to property owners who are already doing exceedingly well in this market. But unfortunately, it's something that we need to look at. We also need to look at, are there available city spaces that we can rent out temporarily? We have some sites that are slated for affordable housing, but we won't be able to build for a couple of years. Are these temporary kind of shared workspaces that we can look at? In the long term, I'm really interested in what we did in the last tech boom, which was acquiring buildings, such as CAS did through several of our foundations. We bought two buildings on Mid-Market and the Tenderloin for Luggage Store Gallery, Hospitality House, and Counterpulse. These are the types of long-term solutions that I'm hoping that we can start to look at and really expand.
And so what is your role on the task force at this point?
So my role was to convene the task force and bring folks together from multiple groups, whether it is our nonprofits, our city departments, and also hopefully property owners, to see what solutions we can come together to provide affordable spaces for our nonprofits. We're also looking for ways to incentivize property owners to provide below market rents to nonprofits as well. And what are incentives that the city can provide so that property owners will do this?
Very well. Well, thanks so much for taking some time out of your evening, Supervisor Jane Kim, to join us on this critical issue and to give your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
So that was Supervisor Jane Kim from District 6 here in San Francisco, the person who convened the analysis that led to the task force that is now looking to solutions to the concern and the rise in rents for nonprofit organizations in San Francisco that threatens their very ability to provide the services and to stay in the city. So I want to move then next to the guests here with me in the studio. This is kind of like the spin section of the show now. So Debbie Lerman, and you're with the San Francisco Human Services Network. And Supervisor Kim mentioned that several of the organizations in the organization that you run were the ones who sounded the alarm. What's your take on the crisis in terms of scope, scale, and where we go next, sort of building on Supervisor Kim's comments?
Well, we first heard about it from a number of our members. They started coming to our meetings saying, hey, we've got a 200% rent increase, or we've lost our space and we're moving to another space and we need hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix the new space up so we can use it, or we can't find anything and we're afraid we're going out of business. So it was bubbling up from our membership. And District 6 really is ground zero for what's going on. It's not the only place in the city. It's extending into the Mission and other neighborhoods, but we're really appreciative of Supervisor Kim's leadership on this issue, because this is a really unique community where you have the wealthiest tenants, the wealthiest companies, literally next door to the most destitute individuals in a community with tremendous poverty and people with many, many challenges. And it's not a happy meeting place often. So something really needed to be done. And Supervisor Kim did take the lead, and she convened a public hearing. She requested the study from the Budget and Legislative Analyst's Office. And we worked with BLA as well to do a survey that went out to about 160 nonprofits. Over 100 of them responded. So I think that right there demonstrated the depth of concern in the community. And I think it's important to point out that we're not vilifying the tech sector here. Our organizations have been through several years of recession, flat funding from the city in our contracts, budgets being slashed year after year in public health and human services at a time of increasing need. Because of this terrible recession. So now we're having a wonderful resurgence in our community. There's a lot of success. The unemployment rate is down. Revenues are up. And it's not about vilifying anybody. It's about making sure that the wonderful benefits that our community is seeing are shared. We have tax breaks going to companies, and the community benefits should be shared as well. And that's that benefit needs to spread to working class people and to those at the lowest end of the income scale. So that's where we want to see this go.
And have any of the organizations in your organization, have they, any of them, had to close their doors or move out of the city in the last few months?
There have been examples of organizations that have moved out of the city. One I'm aware of is the Transgender Law Center. There are, I believe, the Lyon Martin Health Services are at great risk. I don't know the status, but when we did the hearing, which was at this point about 2 months ago, they were concerned about whether they would be closing their doors. So those risks are still there. And in many other situations, organizations were able to find new spaces, but they were less than desirable. They were smaller. A lot of expenses to fix them up. So, yeah, there have been many challenges for those organizations.
On a level across the nation or the state, are you hearing from other organizations like yours that with the turnaround in the economy that their nonprofits are having the same problem right now? Or is this a pretty unique example to San Francisco or maybe other cities like New York?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that San Francisco has been ahead of the curve in terms of an economic resurgence. We're very fortunate, as I said, to have that. So I haven't heard of other communities facing this kind of problem.
So I want to turn next to Brian Chu, and he's a director of community development with the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. And you've been tasked to chair the work group on this very issue that was convened by Supervisor Kim. So thanks for coming on the show tonight.
Thanks.
So I wanted to hear from you what you know about the mayor's perspective on this problem.
Well, I think the mayor realizes the challenges of trying to create an economic revitalization while keeping the city affordable. Our department is trying to grapple with that issue in terms of housing, and we're also grappling with that issue in terms of affordability for nonprofits. And I think, as you earlier were asking about the situation in other cities, I think San Francisco is amongst the highest costing cities of any place in the whole country. So while I think nonprofits throughout the United States struggle with trying to raise funds, very few of them have to struggle with the extremely high rents that San Francisco has. It's rivaled really only by places like Manhattan, Hawaii. It really is at the very top of the cost market. So I think our challenge, as Debbie was mentioning, was how do we try and create a place where the economy is booming. We want the unemployment numbers to go down, but at the same time, we want to be able to keep our nonprofits where they are in the neighborhoods. I think it's often not possible for us to just take a neighborhood-based group, for example, in the Mission and say, we found an affordable place in the Sunset and your clients should be able to go there. That's just really not possible. So that's one of the things that we're struggling with. Debbie also mentioned the fact that many groups have not been able to receive any increases in their contract amounts while their own costs have gone up. I know for our department, we're almost entirely funded by federal community development block grants. So the amount of our block grants have probably gone down by about 20% over the 8 years that I've been there. So if anything, we're giving people fewer dollars. At the same time, the groups have been very generous and have been keeping their deliverables at the same level that they've been sometimes 8 years ago. So they're producing really at a greater level of output than we can support them.
Was the closure of the redevelopment agencies across the state by the governor, did that affect your funding stream as well in this situation?
That did to some limited extent. Most redevelopment agencies were only were not able to support general social services. They were able to support work in economic development and employment. So there were a number of our workforce development groups that depended heavily on the redevelopment agency. So they were very sort of adversely affected by the closure of the agency.
Hmm. And what kind of feedback has the mayor received from the community about this issue? And I'm thinking in particular some of the commentary about how the last election went with the 8 Washington development, sort of sounding this cry of maybe we need to slow down on the city's housing development of luxury apartments. How does this now, this crisis that we're talking about tonight, how does that mesh with that, and what is the mayor hearing from his constituents?
Well, I can't speak to the 8 Washington issue itself, but I know that in our department, we continue to prioritize the production of affordable housing. I think that our department now is trying to maintain our existing pipeline of affordable housing. We're also trying to do whatever we can to really reinvent public housing. A number of the clients that are being served by our social services network live in public housing, and I think if you've read in the newspapers, the conditions there have been really intolerable for a number of years. And we're also trying to create what we administer in terms of our below market rate programs for both rental and home ownership. We realize that whatever we do, there will never be enough. But we are trying to maintain our ability to at least provide some sort of support for affordable housing. And we hope to take some of those lessons that we've learned and apply them to the nonprofit setting. For example, one of the suggestions that will be considered by this working group, I don't know where this suggestion will go right now, but one suggestion that has been put out there and is included in the BLA report was to take the concept that we have for include what we call our inclusionary requirements, meaning that for private residences, when you have a private development, a certain percentage of those residential units should be allocated for below market rate individuals. Could we ever apply that concept in the nonprofit to the nonprofit context, where you could take a certain amount of square footage, for example, in a private commercial development and allocate them towards nonprofits? That's a suggestion that came out in the BLA report. We'd have to examine it more fully to find out whether that's practical. But that's one example.
So my understanding is that you witnessed the dot-com boom bust cycle of not so long ago. And how is this time different with respect to this issue that we're discussing tonight? Is it the same kind of crisis that we saw then? Is it worse this time? What's your perspective?
I don't know if it's necessarily worse in all aspects. I will say that what we've seen from nonprofits, at least over the last 8 years, is that the general atmosphere for fundraising from a variety of sources has become much more difficult. So my impression is that, let's say in the year 2000, while the cost of living and the rental costs may have gone up to the same extent, my impression is that the ability of nonprofits to leverage other funding sources was greater than it is now. My impression now is that overall, there are many people and their ability to give as individuals. Their pocketbooks are tighter. Foundations have really focused in, and it's harder to get private philanthropy to support these groups. So I think that would be one difference now than we had perhaps 13 years ago.
Yeah, because this echoes the question I asked Supervisor Kim about being able to predict, you know, these types of cycles. And of course, this city is not unique in the fact that, you know, cycles happen and they keep repeating themselves. But it just bears the question that I hope we can get into later on in the conversation is how do we smooth out these ups and downs, or are they inevitable moving forward? But before we go there, I want to reintroduce the program. You're listening to City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web from KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing nonprofit displacement here in San Francisco with my guests, We just heard from Brian Chu, Director of Community Development with the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. A little earlier, Debbie Lerman, Administrator of the San Francisco Human Services Network. And at the top of the hour, we heard from Supervisor Jane Kim of District 6. We invite you, our listeners, to join in with your questions and comments at this time. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at cityvisions917@gmail.com or post a comment at klw.org. So, Michael Pappas, I wanted to turn to you next. You're the director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council. Tell us how you came to be concerned about this issue. Are some of the organizations that are part of your council affected in the same ways that we are talking about tonight? And what's your view on this on a broader social level?
Sure. In fact, about 3.5 years ago, our council took the convening role and leadership role of the executive directors of the major faith-based nonprofits here in the city. And to put a face on them, you know their names: GLIDE, Salvation Army, Episcopal Community Services, Catholic Charities, Lutheran Social Services, Jewish Vocational Services, St. Anthony Foundation, St. Vincent de Paul, Jewish Family Children's Services, and the Providence Foundation. Collectively, they serve about 3 million meals a year. When we first began convening them, the city was trying to close a $380 million budget gap. And what was the impact on them? I would say across the board, so many of them that have contracts with the city saw their budgets cut by up to 30%. And so the impact was cutting programs, cutting staff, and basically being told you're going to need to go out and raise the money if you want to be able to keep the services going. And so that was in the worst of the economies. Now it's almost inconceivable 3.5 years later that these are the same folk that are scrambling to be able to stay in the homes that they have just to be able to do their work. I look at Lutheran Social Services, which couldn't afford to renew their lease, and they found a place that was appropriate in the Tenderloin, but now they have to go raise $500,000 in order to make it habitable. I think about Jewish Vocational Services. They lost 4,000 square feet. And here is the agency that is training people for jobs here in the city. And I know that Episcopal Community Services has sort of been put on notice that in 18 months their rents are going up. And I think that this is something that's happening across the board, as Catholic Charities as well had to find a new home. And what's happening is the transition costs are impacting their ability to provide the services that the city is expecting. I do come here also wearing another hat, and that is I'm a member of the San Francisco Human Rights Commission, and I chair the LGBT Advisory Committee. And it's very interesting at the same time that Supervisor Kim was working with Debbie, we have an economic empowerment work group that was very concerned about the impact on the LGBT community and the nonprofits there. And Debbie mentioned the Transgender Law Center leaving. Those are services that are leaving as well. And it's very difficult to tell people here in the city to go over to Oakland when the needs are here and the services ought to be here. And there's another group called the Homeless Youth Alliance, which if they don't come up with the money by December 25th, they're going to have to shut down. They provide services for over 100 homeless youth every day. Over 50% of them claim to be LGBT. So it's not just it's not just one dimension of the sector. These are real people who are being impacted.
Right. And it sounds like the lifeline for a lot of San Franciscans who don't really, you know, who maybe not wouldn't be able to prioritize a BART fare over to Oakland, let's say, if more nonprofits moved over there.
Plus, it's the employees of the nonprofits that are also unable to stay here because of the rising costs of rent as well. So, you know, staying in the neighborhood as well as being able to have your employees in the neighborhood is very significant.
So I want to bring in a couple of voices of organizations that are struggling with this right now. Let's go first to Jessica Love, and she is the executive director of Counterpulse. Jessica, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Thanks for joining us. You were pushed out of the Divisadero area during the previous dot-com boom, if I understand correctly. And then you moved to the mid-market area, and now Twitter has moved in two blocks away. It seems like, you know, the challenge just keeps following you. Tell us what you're dealing with on the ground at this time.
It's true. As you mentioned, we were first on Divisadero Street before it was called NOFA. And, you know, we really only found our current home and our long-term lease at our current home because of the economic downturn. And as I said at one of the hearings that Supervisor Kim called, we don't want to count on another bus to be able to take care of affordable spaces for our arts nonprofit. So right now we're on Mission Street at 9th and Mission. We run a studio theater that has over 200 public events every year. We have 15,000 audience members and 4,000 artists come to our space. And also deep partnerships with social service organizations in our neighborhood. We work with Catholic Charities and Mercy Housing to provide arts experiences for low-income residents. And our lease is up in December of 2015. So we began about a year ago to realize that we weren't going to be able to renew at our current rate. The signs were against that in our current building. And so we began to look elsewhere. And as Supervisor Kim mentioned, we are one of the pilot projects of CAST, the Community Arts Stabilization Trust. So we will be moving to a new home in 2015 on Turk Street in the Tenderloin, and it will be a forever home. So counterfolks will be able to stay here and provide community arts activities to low-income residents forever. But to do that, we're actually launching an upwards of $5 million capital campaign to pay for renovations and then to repay CAST so that they can go ahead and help other nonprofit arts organizations.
So it sounds like this uprooting and then having to pull on money to renovate could be used to actually provide the funding for the services you want, and now there's kind of this diversion of funds.
Absolutely.
So to speak. Yeah.
So, well, the arts
so tell us how that's going to set you back.
The arts are so site-specific. So, you know, we can't just like Debbie was saying, we can't do what we do from an office in Oakland. This is about being a live space where people can come together and experience performance. And it takes a lot of investment to be able to turn a storefront or an empty warehouse into a theater. And those investments can't come with you when you move. So Counterpulse is going to, I mean, we are lucky in that we have this partnership with several foundations and we're receiving some support from the city. But not all arts organizations are in the position to launch a major capital campaign. And in fact, many of them aren't. And, you know, I think what's really valuable and a little bit different about the arts is that, you know, we're part of what makes San Francisco so vibrant and unique and diverse, and a big part of the reason that tech workers and all workers really want to be living in our city. And so we can't allow the arts to be a victim of our own success.
Well, thanks so much, Jessica Love, Executive Director of Counterpulse, for giving us your perspective. I want to turn next to Mark Burns. He is Deputy Director of In-Home Supportive Services Consortium. Mark, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks for having us.
So tell us a little bit about your organization and who you serve and what you're facing at this time in terms of rental issues.
So for the past 18 years, the consortium has been a major contractor to Human Services. We have a workforce of about 430 home care providers who assist frail elderly and people with disabilities to remain safely in their homes rather than be in long-term support services like Laguna Honda. We have an administrative staff of about 60, and because our workforce is transit-dependent and because they often work multiple shifts, many of them in the heart of the city, we really need to be where we have been for the past 18 years, right in the mid-market corridor. About in March of 2011, as Supervisor Kim said, it really at the bottom of our economy, we took what we thought was a really wonderful opportunity to move into Fox Plaza at $18 a square foot for about 17,000 square feet of space. And yes, directly across the street from today's home of Twitter. In May of this year, our landlord gave us a six-month termination notice and offered to renew our lease at $45 a square foot. The impact to the city, had they had to carry the increased rate of our rent, would have been over $500,000 a year. I feel really fortunate on one hand that we've actually been able to find a space. We did find one space. We'll be moving in early January. We're going to be staying in mid-market. We're moving to 1035. We are having to downsize by more than 20%, and we are moving into the basement of the building. We're going for 10 years, so I feel sort of like I have committed my staff to living underground for the next decade, and when we come up, we probably won't be able to afford to stay in the neighborhood again, assuming mid-market continue its current trend. But at least we're able to stay successfully. The other side of this is that we have had to cobble together. I mean, no move is free, and we just moved a few years ago. So we've had to cobble together monies to be able to help us move. And that means cutting a number of things out of our budget this year. And in total, we'll spend more than $200,000 just relocating three blocks up the street.
And so how is this downsizing you're talking about and the move, and how is this affecting the scope of your services and what you'll be able to provide moving forward?
Well, you know, I think the fortunate side is, of course, that we're able to stay in the mid-market neighborhood. I think the question is, as we go to renew our budgets for the next couple of years, we, like everybody else in this market, we have escalators that are going to increase our rent year over year. We'll be actually moving up to a total of $38 a square foot over the next decade. And the city is our primary contractor. 98% of our funding comes from the city. So either we're going to have to look at a reduction in our service hours, or the city's going to need to increase the budget allotment.
And do you have any recommendations about what could be some good long-term solutions at this point?
Well, so I happen to be a member of Brian's work group, and talking to Supervisors Kim's office about this since last August. I think that there's been a lot of really great movement. It's wonderful to see how many folks in the city are really getting on board with this. And I really echo Supervisor Kim's ideas that there are some short-term solutions for people who are really caught in a tremendous bind right now. And I think that there's a great array of some creative solutions that are very near term. But really, there needs to be a systemic long-term solution to this. There needs to be some way to create permanent long-term homes for the nonprofits, because the nonprofits are incredibly important part of the economic fabric and the social fabric of the city. So I think that the finding a permanent solution, probably that means either some sort of build-buy real estate solution, in my mind, is what we need to look at. I spent a couple of years working in Berkeley at the Ed Roberts campus, which is a great example of a public-private partnership, I think, that brought the disability community together out there and gave them a permanent home in Berkeley. I'd like to see San Francisco do something very similar to that.
Well, thanks so much for taking some time out to join us tonight. That was Mark Burns, Deputy Director of In-Home Supportive Services Consortium here in San Francisco. And I want to take a moment to again reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing nonprofit displacement in San Francisco with my guests, Brian Chu of the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, Debbie Lerman, San Francisco Human Services Network, and Michael Pappas of the San Francisco Interfaith Council. And I would like to invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. Has a local nonprofit you're affiliated with or familiar with been affected by rising rents? And how, if at all, should the city address this issue? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com or post a comment on klw.org. So let's go to Nancy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. This is Nancy Nielsen, and I'm Deputy Director of Lutheran Social Services, another one of those nonprofits being displaced. So thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it. All of the comments, and I resonate with what's being said. We have been in the South of Market area for about 9 years, and last April, our landlord informed us that he would not renew our lease, which expires in April 2014, as he had a new tenant, a tech company, that would pay double what we were paying.
So Nancy, I'm going to ask you, in case you have your radio on still, to turn that down because it's giving us some feedback here.
It's off. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
So we were informed last April that we needed to find a new home, and we've spent about 6 months looking and negotiating a lease. And like Mark, we've been fortunate to find a location back in the Tenderloin where we need to be, where our 1,800 clients also reside. We were fortunate to find a landlord, a building owner, who was willing to work with a nonprofit and to negotiate a rent that we could manage. But as has been mentioned earlier, the amount of renovations that need to happen to create not only a functional space, but a safe space for our staff and for our clients, it's a significant investment, and the initial estimates were over $500,000. So it's a big task. We didn't feel we had any other option but to take it on and to step up and invite others to step up with us. But we're, you know, incredibly grateful for the conversation that Supervisor Kim has started and Brian and the others on the task force. I think this is really a big part of the solution. It's the community-wide conversation. The things that are happening to the nonprofits now are part of policy decisions that were made. And most policy decisions, I think we always find out, have unintended consequences. And this was certainly, I believe, an unintended consequence, but it is an opportunity for the city and everyone in it to say, okay, what do we want our community to be? What is it that makes the city vibrant and cares for its most vulnerable people, while at the same time being having a thriving arts community? So it is time for that citywide conversation, and we're delighted to be part of it, not for the, you know, not without some pain, but it is a good opportunity.
Well, thanks so much, Nancy, for your call.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to go to a couple of comments that we also received. We had a comment at klw.org from Bill. He states, I serve as the director of a nonprofit that provides legal services to people living with HIV/AIDS. Our rent will more than double in March of this new year. Most of our city contracts are grant funded. So even when the city provides a minimal CODB increase, makes it cost of doing business increase to contractors. I'm used to COLA. So we don't see any of that increase, yet our costs continue to go up each year, rent, salaries, benefits. In the last dot-com bubble, we doubled our rent in the city through the Mayor's Office of Community Development, gave out small grants to nonprofits to ease the pain of the increased rent. It would be great if the city could do that again. Of course, it would be even better if the city increased its funding to nonprofits that actually considered what the increased cost of doing business, essential business, are for nonprofits. I fear that if the city does not act soon, there may be some agencies which cannot absorb the costs, and there will be dramatic reductions in services to our most vulnerable residents. And then an email that we received from Michael at cityvisions917@gmail.com. Grey Panthers had their rent raised from $325 to $1,750 after 25 years in the same office. It later turned out that the building owner wanted us to leave because he wanted to consolidate his offices from several other buildings into our building, so there was no room for us. We lucked out and finally found a place smaller with higher rent, but the story demonstrates how the turmoil in the commercial property market damages nonprofits and community-based organizations beyond the direct rent hikes. Ed Lee lets his corporate friends move into the city without paying taxes, so there isn't enough room for our services. Then his real estate friends get rich from rising rents, and we have to move out. What a system. So, so Brian Chu, I do have to turn to you next here. Not necessarily to answer to these, but to say what's possible at this point? What is the mayor prepared to do in the short term? And then I'd like to hear about the long-term strategies.
Sure. Well, we divided our task force up into sort of three different areas. Short-term solutions, solutions that we might be able to do even within the first 120 days, medium-term solutions, so things that might take a year or perhaps 2 years, and then long-term where it might take more than 2 years. Some of the things that we're looking at in terms of our short-term solutions is, as people have talked about today, looking right now at some of those unutilized or underutilized city properties. So we have the director of the Department of Real Estate as part of our working group to be able to look at those places which long-term or maybe even temporarily, maybe for a year or two, we could locate some necessary services. For example, we know that the former administrative offices for the Housing Authority at 440 Turk Street will be vacant for at least one, perhaps 2 years, and that's a site that's right in the central part of the city. Almost nothing is happening in that space right now, so could we be able to do that? We might be able to provide or subsidize some sort of brokerage services. Often nonprofits don't have the capacity or the personnel to actually spend a lot of time. It actually takes a great deal of time and expertise to go out into the commercial real estate market, and people aren't usually knowledgeable in that area, so we might be able to provide them with that kind of service. There are some nonprofits that actually specialize in analyzing the kinds of spaces that are necessary for nonprofits. So there's one group, the Northern California Community Loan Fund, that has a great deal of expertise in this area. They provided some solutions back in the year 2000. And they were very instrumental in working with many arts organizations in mid-market. In fact, I think they have a contract with the Arts Commission to enable them to provide some of these consulting services. We may be able to expand that to the general group of nonprofits. We may be able to work with groups like the Office of Economic Workforce Development to identify commercial vacant storefronts. Maybe that could be a possibility in some commercial corridors. We're talking to the planning department. Sometimes there are zoning restrictions would make it very difficult for nonprofits to move into certain spaces. Can we relax that? On the medium-sized side, medium-term solutions, we could look at actually the possibility of co-locating groups. Perhaps some groups could share one space. Maybe they could share some back office space. Some people have even talked about looking at some of the innovative work on the private for-profit space, where it's not only co-locating, it's actually co-working, where you actually share the same desk. Hard for me to imagine how that might work sometimes if people saw my desk, but apparently some people might be able to do that. And then some of the we're looking at the possibility of even something like development impact fees. So some people may be aware that if there is an appropriate kind of what we call a nexus or connective study, you may be able to show that development in a certain area imposes certain costs in a neighborhood, at which case you may be able to impose certain developer impact fees. You may not be able to use that for rental subsidies, but you can use that for bricks and mortar. So if you need to acquire a space within that neighborhood, you might be able to do that. And then in terms of long-term solutions, as I mentioned before, you may be able to provide some sort of inclusionary zoning requirement so that, again, through zoning, you may be able to require that developers set aside a certain amount of space within their buildings. So we are hoping that we will be able to come up with the final version of our report around April 11th or so. We've got about three more meetings of the working groups between now and April, and according to the terms of Supervisor Kim's resolution, we need to come up with that report within 120 days. So by April 11th, we'll be able to put forth a comprehensive set of recommendations.
Thank you for quite an expansive discussion there about the potential options. I'm curious, what happens to nonprofits who are in trouble between now and April?
You know, I think that's one of the most difficult aspects, but I think that in terms of possible options, I think it really is something like identifying those spaces that are available right now. So, for example, you know, I was talking to the chair of the Housing Authority Commission, actually is a part of this working group. And just today he told me again that he had spoken with one of the deputies at the Housing Authority saying, we've got this space that's vacant right now. So I think the question is, how do we do a kind of a matchmaking, so to speak? How do we get the spaces that are available and the nonprofits make sure they align in terms of the space and the function and the clientele? How can we do that within the next 120 days? I think that would be a challenge for the city partners and for the nonprofits to try and have that conversation.
Any thoughts about that, Debbie?
I think that we do need, as Brian has laid out, a whole portfolio of solutions, both short and long term.
But I'm talking about ultra short.
And in terms of the ultra, yes. The unnecessary evil solution is dollars. And it's really unfortunate, as Supervisor Kim pointed out, ultimately if the city is paying more in rent, it really is going to property owners who are doing quite well. Yet that may be the only thing we can do in the next 6 to 12 months to keep nonprofits existing. You know, the city relies on nonprofit organizations to provide services. They are the primary providers in areas such as homeless services, seniors, children, HIV/AIDS. We cannot let these organizations go away. When we did the survey, 71% said that location was crucial to their mission. You can't take a nonprofit providing services in the Tenderloin. 50% of the city's homelessness are in District 6. You can't move that organization somewhere else. So the city is invested in those services. The city is relying on those nonprofits to provide those services there. and sadly may have to pay more dollars until we can come up with something better.
And that reminds me, Brian, of a question, which is, you know, from the city's perspective, the return on investment in a quarter of these nonprofits is obviously going to suffer if a lot more of the money has to be spent towards rent rather than services in the short and long term. What is the city looking at? And maybe you don't know this, but I'm curious if the city has also seen thought about how there's going to be a decline in the objectives they're looking for if nonprofits are being diverted from the providing services to just trying to figure out how to keep their doors open.
Well, I think that's a good point and something that we've talked about in our working group, that it's terrible to have to ask nonprofits to make that choice. Do we cut money from salaries, which are already low to begin with, and move it into the rent? There were some nonprofits at the table that said, if you can't give us anything, at least give us the flexibility so within our existing contracts we can move a line item from one category, let's say salary, to rent. Nobody thinks that's the best solution. We already know nonprofit workers are sort of at the bottom of the pay scale. I think that what the nonprofits have expressed to the city is that they don't want to have to make that choice. They've already come to us in the past saying, you know, we haven't been able to give cost of living increases to our workers. We're not where we need to be there. And we're making this request, but we don't want one to replace the other. I don't know what the city's going to be able to do around this. I do know that, for example, Supervisor David Chu has been reviewing the increase in property taxes in the mid-market area to see what that number could look like. It'll probably be up to the board and other powers that be as to what might happen if there is a larger than expected property tax base. I think that we would be looking to other possible solutions in order to be able to fill that gap without people having to make those extraordinarily difficult choices.
Would a nonprofit trust fund come out of this, a la the Affordable Housing Trust Fund that the mayor created through his coalitions last year? Do you think that's a possibility here as well?
It's an interesting idea. I think all ideas are on the table. We're in the brainstorm phase at this point.
So, Michael, I wanted to turn to you about solutions. Either commenting on some of the ones you've heard or thinking even broader than the ones that were mentioned here. Tell us how you see this problem in terms of solutions.
It's interesting. I was asked, well, what are we supposed to do? I'm really privileged. I live in the Presidio, and I work in the Presidio. And there are days I feel like we could take a page out of the Presidio Trust's playbook, because back in the mid-90s when the post decommissioned, they knew they had to be solvent by 2013, but at the same time they wanted to create a sense of community. And I'm the executive director of a nonprofit. I don't make a lot of money, but they wanted to make sure that people like me had a place to live so that we could do our work. And so they created the preferred leasing program in the Presidio, which is really what enables me to be able to live in the city and county of San Francisco. And I'm not saying that this is what we need to do, but I think what distinguishes San Francisco is our sense of philanthropy, our sense of valuing philanthropy as part of the social fabric. And I think that we have a real unique challenge. I'm thrilled to hear some of the options Brian's talking about, because I guess we've always been looked to be the creative thinkers, to be the thought leaders. And I think that this is something that we need to be doing. But the one thing that really concerns me, and I think you had your finger on the pulse, is the fact that the economic momentum is moving so quickly that I'm just hoping that policy can keep up with it.
And how about reaching out to some of these tech companies to have them be part of the solution? Do you see that as a strategy? And I'd open that to any of you at this point.
I think that that's going to have to be a necessity. And all we need to do is look to the tradition of philanthropy in the city, because in essence, those people who have made have given. And that has been such a rich part of the tradition of San Francisco. And so I think that perhaps there needs to be the elder generation perhaps needs to help foster that with the newer generation.
Brian, you want to add something?
I agree with that. That's a suggestion that has come up out of the working group, as well as city departments and nonprofits. We do have participation by some members of social philanthropy. So, for example, the San Francisco Foundation, which was a partner back in the early 2000s, is again a partner here. And, you know, we'd love to see other corporations, tech companies, and other companies. There's been many corporate partners that have long time been supporters of nonprofits, and we'd love them to be part of the solution also.
Are they at the table currently?
Foundations, yes. Corporations, not so far. So we're still exploring who we might reach out to become part of the discussion.
Okay. And I want to bring in a caller here. Andre, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. My name is Andre Grasse. I volunteer in the Tenderloin with low-income children. I understand that your program is in regard to the displacement of nonprofits, but the vulnerable families and seniors in the Tenderloin are being displaced at a phenomenal rate. They may not really truly understand their rights as far as staying in their homes. Now, who will these nonprofits be serving if the people they serve are displaced? That's my first question. Secondly, I'm wondering, what is being discussed to partner the organizations of the nonprofits with the displacement of families and seniors in these areas?
Great. Thanks so much. I'm going to have you take your answer off the air. Brian, did you want to approach either of those questions?
In terms of the displacement of individuals, I think that what we're struggling with now is the inability to provide enough affordable housing so these individuals do have a permanently affordable residence. You may know, with our inclusionary housing program, 12%. Around 12% of a commercial development needs to be dedicated to below market, either rental or home ownership. That's 12% is still not enough to cover all of the needs of people that need that low cost housing. Similarly, with affordable housing, we'd love to be able to provide even more 100% affordable buildings. Now, the cost to create even one unit of affordable housing can be close to $500,000 just to produce one unit. So the financing for that becomes so great that there's no way that we can, even in the best of boom times, we've never been able to create enough affordable housing. And so I think it has been a challenge. We'll do our best, but I'm not sure that the creation of affordable housing will ever be the permanent solution to creating housing in San Francisco.
And I wanted to ask Michael and Debbie to comment on this in the last minute or so of the show. What does this tell us about how nonprofits need to look at their business model moving forward so that they're more protected against these ups and downs and that their margins aren't so razor thin? Any thoughts about that as part of the long-term strategy here?
Well, one thing I just have to mention from the previous caller, I think it's ironic that a couple of eviction defense organizations have lost their space in the Tenderloin. But in terms of, I think that we just need to keep partnering with the city to find those solutions. I think it is important that the city does find a way to address the flat funding issue that nonprofits go through so that we can keep our finances in order.
And just one brief comment on the last caller. I was sitting at a San Francisco Foundation meeting, and we were talking about the rents here. We have to understand that this is a regional issue, because when people leave here, they go out to West Oakland or to Contra Costa County, and they drive the rents up there as well. So people are getting forced out of vulnerable neighborhoods, not just here, but also in those places as well.
Okay. And so, Brian and Debbie, how can people who are interested follow the discussions that the task force is having and follow this issue moving forward?
Well, the media has been doing a great job of covering it, I have to say. We have a number of local papers that hopefully will continue to keep this in the public eye.
And are minutes of your meetings public at this point? Are the meetings at all? Is there going to be a public comment period at all, Brian?
I think there will be a public comment. You know, we plan to have the draft available in March, so that we'll have a full month for people to comment. And if people have questions, feel free to call our office at 415-701-5500. Again, 415-701-5500. That's our office's number, and we can get in contact with any individual who has questions.
And we'll post that on our website. So that's our program for this evening. I want to thank Brian Chu of the Mayor's Office on Housing and Community Development, Debbie Lerman of the San Francisco Human Services Network, Michael Pappas of the San Francisco Interfaith Council, and earlier Supervisor Jane Kim, Jessica Love of CounterPulse, and Mark Burns of In-Home Supportive Services Consortium. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts, and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Thanks to our engineer, Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by our senior producer, Susie Britton. We're off for the holidays for the next two Mondays, and we'll be with you again live on January 6th when we discuss new research on sticking with those New Year's resolutions. From all of us here at City Visions, this is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and happy holidays.